Donald Trump won in 2016 because he came to Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Ohio and Michigan because he said, look, these politicians have been fucking you over with NAFTA for years. And the thing is, he's right. It's just people like you and I knew he wasn't going to do shit about it, but he was right about that. And that's why the UAW, 50% of the UAW voted for Donald Trump.
We have an opportunity to not only protest in the streets and protest at the ballot box, but to protest in the halls of power. And it is a testament to UAW that the halls of power have come to you, because they understand that this is a union, not of words, but of deeds. That this is a union that stands not against things, but for the people.
Every time I see people address this question, and especially if it's like white feminists doing it, I see this pattern that they're just like obsessed with migrant maids and sex workers.
Yeah.
And from what I have seen from these white women doing these investigations and becoming experts, is that they will cosplay as like maids and then be like, you know, I didn't feel empowered cleaning up toilets. It felt very disempowering for me. Like, if these women had PhDs, they would never choose this. You know, they're migrants. They don't have, like, no woman can ever choose this.
I've grown up playing PlayStation and Xbox. I'm pretty handy with internet and teaching like that. But there are some teachers who are really good teachers who this is a totally new experience for them, teaching remotely, teaching online. So it's overwhelming for teachers and students and parents and everyone in between.
There's a space to make pretty good quality jobs, union jobs directly within the cannabis industry. So that's, you know, workers who will be in cultivation centers, processing, distribution within the retail dispensaries. But what doesn't necessarily get a lot of attention also is all the different ancillary businesses that are going to be opened.
Dr. King said that the power to bring about social change is called, by and large, between two movements, the workers' movement and the social and religious movement.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, we start off with two takes on labor and politics that in some ways come from very different places and in other ways come from very much the same place. On the Blue Collar Gospel Hour, host Dan Denton and his fellow autoworker Trey Garcia react to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol last month with frustration over the failure of both parties to speak to or for working people. And on Building Bridges Radio, Fair Fight Action founder Stacey Abrams, who's been nominated for this year's Nobel Peace Prize, talks about how the American working class has consistently relied on people of color and women to push for improved status for workers, but has been slow to include them in the movement's victories. Next up, Jesse Sage interviews sex worker, activist, writer, undocumented migrant, and DACA recipient Maya Morena on the Working People podcast about the politics of the sex industry and the history of vice. On My Labor Radio, Indiana teacher Tim Barr discusses life in school for both teachers and students during a pandemic. As New York State faces a multi-billion dollar deficit, the Union Strong podcast explores how adult-use cannabis offers an opportunity to build a new industry from the ground up in a way that will raise revenue, create good union jobs, and address social, racial, and economic equity. And from the Black Work Talk podcast, we'll hear about the relationship between Black unionists, the civil rights and Black power movements, and the labor movement from longtime labor organizer and leader Bill Lucy, co-founder of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Blue Collar Gospel Hour. I'm here with my union brother, Trey Garcia. How you doing, Trey?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much.
Donald Trump won in 2016 because he came to Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Ohio and Michigan He won Michigan, for God's sake.
Yeah.
It's the first Republican since Reagan. Because he said, look, these politicians have been fucking you over with NAFTA for years. And the thing is, he's right. It's just people like you and I knew he wasn't going to do shit about it. But he was right about that. And that's why the UAW, 50% of the UAW voted for Donald Trump.
I completely
agree.
That's
a problem in the UAW that the UAW has not addressed yet, by the way.
I don't think you will see them address that.
No, but they should.
Oh, I completely agree.
But then you saw immediately after he was elected, and his fight with that carrier president from the carrier union, and how they still lost some jobs.
Uh-huh.
Since he got elected, Lordstown closed. Remember, he went to Lordstown and promised, you'll never lose a job here, motherfucker.
I believe today GM has closed 5 factories in the United States and has continued to outsource jobs, regardless of what Donald Trump promised or said.
Yeah, absolutely not, man. Like, none of them. And I suspected that was going to happen, you know. Plus, me being who I am, I can't overlook the undertone of racism and white power and nationalism behind his message a lot of times. And I'm not, part of me has always tried to hold my tongue because I'm so tired of fighting and losing friends, Trey. And I know that you understand this. But then the other part of me is ashamed that I haven't spoke out more. And so I've just decided once they try to overrun the Capitol building and overthrow my country, that it's free for me to say whatever the fuck I want about these miserable pieces of shit. They're traitors, man. God damn it, they're traitors, Trey.
I've went very far in the past.
I don't even like the government. I shouldn't have to defend it. But that's traitor. That's treason.
I completely agree.
That's an attempted coup.
You had people that were rushing the Capitol, and they were claiming this is a revolution.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no doubt about it.
Like, I'm a guy that dreams of revolution.
Yeah.
And I felt bad. Like, I didn't know. I was just telling a family member today that I felt bad because I wasn't sure which side to root for. I knew I couldn't be on the Trump side. Crazy, I can't be on that cold side. But I really don't like the politicians, you know?
It seemed rather ironic that...
I know they don't work for me. Can I say that? I can say that. Fuck them.
The law and order crowd wasn't very orderly at the Capitol, let's just say. I found it really ironic, and it almost kind of chuckled until I saw the devastation of what actually occurred. Yeah.
Once enough people believe that have a lack of confidence in our elections, we're in trouble. That's a country.
I think you started to see that come to a head these days. And it's not just people on the right or people that support Trump that are claiming that our legitimate democratic process of elections have been turned an ugly eye these days.
And we know about some of that. Like, we've seen... This is going to get us in trouble, Trey. You're afraid of getting in trouble?
Not today.
We've seen the DNC close election halls in minority communities. We've seen Democrats close all but eight election halls in Phoenix in 2016. Like, even the Democrats, like, and this is what I tell people, Trey, and I know you agree with this. I know you've heard me say it. The real problem is, as long as politicians are accepting millions of dollars from corporations that employ me and you, it's impossible for them to have our best interest.
I think you see some of that as these day and age, especially when you go from Bush, Trump, or Bush, Obama, then Trump, you'll see that a lot of the same corporate donors backed all three of them.
Yes.
I mean, they're not choosing sides. They're choosing the winner.
Yes.
So, I mean, we're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place these days when do our elections really matter? Yes.
Yes.
But are they bought? To a certain extent,
sort of.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, all right, man. Thanks for coming over, Trey.
Thanks
for listening, everybody. And stay tuned. More quality content and guests coming soon.
We're building bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Now, Stacey Abrams, founder of Fair Fight Action, and author of Our Time Is Now and Lead from the Outside.
Stacey Abrams, as she speaks before an audience of United Automobile Workers.
It is just an honor to be here. I began my work on voting rights as a college student, but I came by it honestly. My parents were activists in the civil rights movement. My dad was arrested in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, registering voters. The issue was he was 14 and it was during Jim Crow. He was arrested helping an older black man get inside the courthouse to register to vote. We like to tease them that my mom was across town doing the same work. She was just smart enough not to get caught. But they wanted us to understand from our earliest moments the power of the right to vote, the power of our citizenship. But they also wanted us to understand that that power would only get stronger if it was shared. And so at the age of 17, I set up a table at Spelman College to register my fellow students at Spelman and Morehouse and Clark Atlanta and Morris Brown. And I was one of the loneliest 17-year-olds on the quad because no one wanted to stop by that table and register to vote. But I've been raised to believe that it's not about what people want. It's about what they need. And there was no stronger an advocate as I built my work as a college student than the labor unions of Georgia. I was a part of Frontlash. I worked with the A. Philip Randolph Institute. And it was President Lane Kirkland who invited me in 1993 as a college junior at Spelman to speak at the 1993 30th anniversary of the March on Washington. I still remember standing there at that podium, looking across the reflecting pool, looking at that monument, and being more terrified than I have ever been in my life, because my God, that's a lot of people, demanding access to jobs, to justice, and to peace. It was in 2010 when I stood to become minority leader, when I asked my colleagues that the nadir of our power as Democrats, when we'd lost every statewide office, we'd lost the House to near supermajority, and the Senate had gone to a supermajority. Republicans barely had to talk to us if they wanted to get things done. It was then that I asked if I could become the leader, if I could step forward and help us get back to power, but not the power of compromise, not the power of putting our needs aside just so we could survive, but a power that said we deserve to demand what we are entitled to. And as I stood before my colleagues, I said, look, I've been a minority for a very long time. I am really good at it. Let me take this job. And I think they let me have it because barely anybody else wanted it. But over the next 10 years, I built a plan because I believed in the capacity of the state of Georgia. I believed in the capacity of the South. I believed in the capacity of communities of color to be in coalition with good people of good heart and good intent to create better. And it was in 2012 when I was facing a gerrymandered map that had given me 56 members out of 180. A gerrymandered map that had crushed and cracked and eliminated jobs, eliminated opportunity, had removed members who had been doing good work. It was at that moment that I turned to labor and I said, look, we're not going to win back the House anytime soon. I'm barely keeping my head above water, and my mission is simply to stop them from getting us to below 60. Because if we got to 60, we could at least stop constitutional amendments. And when I talked to donors in other places, they all looked at me. They're like, it's Georgia. What are you fighting for? But it was labor. When I talked to labor and said, look, I think we can organize our way to success, it was labor that said, we are with you. We have your back. And in 2020, when we went across this country saying, look at Georgia, we are ready, it was labor that answered the call. And in 2021, when we had to win those two seats to guarantee that democracy could thrive in this nation, labor stood with me and made certain that we had organizers to do the work, because labor is always standing where good can be done. And that is why I am so honored to receive an award that talks about social justice, but I know that it's not about the work that I do. I've been privileged to be in spaces and to be raised by parents who taught me to fight even if you weren't going to win, because sometimes the fight is all you have. That is what I learned from my parents, and that is what I have seen from labor over the last decade, over the last 25 years. This commitment not to trying to be victorious at all costs, but a commitment to being right and being good and never, ever counting the cost. Because organizers believe that if there is something to be done, it is our job to do it. And while I may not have ever been a member of a union formally, I hope you know I will always be a sister in spirit, and I will always be a fighter beside you. Because now that we have a president who once again has restored the dignity of this office and who is using his power to support the people of this nation, now that we have a U.S. Senate with two extraordinary men from the great state of Georgia, we have good work to do. I am privileged to have lived in the 5th Congressional District in Georgia, to count John Lewis not only as my congressman, but as my friend. And people are fond of quoting his good trouble speeches. But what I remember about him is that when we had to fight against this Muslim ban, John Lewis wasn't sitting in his office. He was at the airport when I got there. And when people tried to strip women and men of their right to love who they wanted to love, he was not sitting in his office cowering. He was in the streets fighting. And that is what labor does. Labor speaks up for the voiceless. It stands up for those who have been knocked down. And it does the work of making justice and jobs and peace real. Because too often we hear those words and we see those mantras and we start to believe that it's just a fairy tale. But I know it's real. Because I grew up in a family best described as working poor. My mother, genteel poor. We didn't have money, but we watched PBS and we read books. My parents raised us to understand that it was our responsibility not to dwell in the lack in our house, the lights being cut off and the running water being a distant memory. That it was our job to go out and serve others. What they told us is that having nothing is not an excuse for doing nothing. And what labor embodies every single day, what you all celebrate with your work every single day, is that people deserve, they deserve to not have to fight every single day. And you stand up not only for those who join your union, you stand up for those who scream at you and try to send you away. Because that's where justice lies, when you are willing to speak up not only for those who share your beliefs, but when you're willing to defend those who would destroy those beliefs. I am honored because I know that I am in the company of men and women of good conscience, of good hearts, and of good values. People who believe that the pandemic didn't create injustice, it simply revealed it. People who understand that our obligation is not to simply rest on our success on January 5th and November 3rd, but to demand that the next November and the November after that, that those Novembers will never again look as dark as they did in the last 4 years. We have an opportunity to not only protest in the streets and protest at the ballot box, but to protest in the halls of power. And it is a testament to UAW that the halls of power have come to you, because they understand that this is a union not of words, but of deeds. That this is a union that stands not against things, but for the people. And as we head into a month, the month that celebrates Black history, I like to remind us all that Black history is not about celebrating Blackness. It's about acknowledging that American history requires our participation. And that as we think about the future of our nation, it's going to require the participation of so many of us who are left out and left behind, who are relegated to the shadows instead of brought into the light. But it's the work you're going to do to make real Chuck Schumer's request that we have, by the flick of that pen, the erasure of debt that is holding our communities back, that we push for Social Security changes that actually celebrate the work that has been done and acknowledges the fights that are to come. That what we have to do with COVID vaccines is acknowledge the legitimacy of suspicion, but the efficacy of delivery. And that we remember that even those who say that labor holds them back, that we will fight on, because it is labor that has delivered so many of the changes for social justice in this country. It is labor that has fueled and funded and lifted up our nation. And I am here to tell you that I stand with you, as I did in 93, as I did in 2010, as I did in 2018, as I will as long as I have breath. I stand with labor because labor stands for America. Thank you so much.
Stacey Abrams, indeed. All labor has dignity. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.
Oh!
Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red.
welcome everyone to another episode of Working People, a podcast about the lives, jobs, dreams, and struggles of the working class today. Brought to you in partnership with In These Times magazine and the Real News Network. In these episodes, you're going to hear an expansive, rich, and wonderful conversation between Jesse and Maya Morena. Maya is a brilliant writer, activist, and sex worker, and she is also an undocumented migrant and DACA recipient from Honduras. And
so, welcome, Maya.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you. Can you introduce yourself and how, I don't want to ask, like, how did you get into sex work? But let's like talk a little bit about your life story, because it's very interwoven with your sex work.
Yeah, it definitely is. I don't really even know when I really started to do sex work. I feel like it just has been a while now. So I start my sex work story usually when I decided to really commit and go full time, which was like around when Trump was like running for office, where I was like, oh, no, this is going to go to shit.
Yeah,
it was bad. But it was also because I knew that one of his campaign promises was that he was going to eliminate DACA. And I talked about this in like my former Tumblr a lot, that I really didn't know what to do. I was working retail at the time, just like a lot of retail sales jobs. And I was just tired of it. I was really tired. And I really wanted to go all out in the sex industry, which I had dipped my toes in numerous times and with varying degrees of success, but I really just wanted to go in all in, because I felt that if he was going to get rid of DACA, then I wouldn't have working rights and I could make money underground and be able to survive that way and be able to thrive that way as well. I had this vision that I would live in luxury after the dystopian nightmare started. So I think one of the big issues with Swerves is that when I was a SWERF, you get obsessed with these really weird conversations that don't matter.
Okay. Like, what's a good example of that?
Is sex work ever empowering?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's another one?
Is it possible for a sex worker to have agency because maybe
they never made a choice? That was
They're living under false consciousness, and so that's like something that it's impossible to argue out of. If you say, "I feel like I'm making a choice to do that," and they're like, "Yeah, but you aren't actually, because you live under false consciousness," or
argue out of it. But the only way to argue against it is to basically call out these questions and conversations for what they are, and they're bullshit. They're meaningless bullshit. I've done I've written some stuff about it as well, but then it didn't get published by the newspaper. I feel like I go a little too hard sometimes, because I'll use words like neoliberal and I'll talk about colonialism, and I'm like, maybe I should take that out for major newspapers. I don't think they're going to publish this, and then they don't. I went on like several libertarian places and they took out most of what I said and only had like me laughing for a bit. And I was like, God damn it. I should have given my message to them. The choice and empowerment debate, they're really meaningless. It's really hard to get, especially leftists, to move away from that, because they really think it's like the height of intellectualism. Like that's the question that sex work needs to answer.
It's interesting because I just wrote an article about that. And the reason that I wrote an article about it was because the fucking Julie Bendel wrote this dumb article like several months ago where she was talking about how OnlyFans isn't empowering. And I was like, who cares? Like, why should we care if OnlyFans is empowering? It's a job. Like, we don't have this discussion about any other profession as if it's supposed to be empowering. That's like a nice fantasy, but is any, like, why are we even talking about like work like that? I just think it's interesting because I feel like sex work gets held to a standard that like nothing else gets held to.
Which one do you want to tackle first, the choice or the empowerment one?
Let's talk about empowerment.
So empowerment is a very interesting word because it's used to sell shit. It's a marketing word. So a lot of people will say, especially in feminist discourse, feminism has become corporatized and is often used to sell development. Otherwise known as colonialism in the third world. And that's those are the exact words they use. Oh, we need to build sweatshops for women because empowerment. We need to bulldoze this Native people's homes. And we have women developers doing it. Empowerment right. for women. Yay.
Right. Literally right.
what this stuff looks like globally. But I feel like a lot of leftists don't spend time looking into this. And I think they really just don't know. They genuinely yeah. don't know what happens. Mm-hmm. So they don't really see it, but you can even see it like in a lot of the conversations that happen that happens around these issues. Like mm-hmm. every time women do anything, it's, oh, is it empowering though? Like women are having casual sex and they're wearing dresses. They are drinking beer and they're going out and they think they can have it all, but can they really? And is it empowering to want to have it all? Is it empowering right. for women? It's just an endless conversation. So
yeah, I know.
Is it yeah. empowering for women to twerk? Is right. so being fat, is that empowering for all women? It's just yeah. an endless mm-hmm. conversation. It's a meaningless conversation. If you want to engage with it, fine. But the correct answer is that it doesn't matter. Women right. are not. Right. Women are human beings. They're not symbols and metaphors.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. I think that's why it's a question that feminists ask, like in bad faith too, I think. I think it's almost used in the way that you're talking about. It's used in the way to justify these sort of like colonial projects, but it's also used to tear down like sex work or things. And it also is used to make it so that sex workers, I think, feel like they're not allowed to talk about the very like real reality of their work. If you're like set up to have to prove that your work is empowering, what does that do when it doesn't feel that way?
Yeah. The word empowerment itself, the way that the corporations use it and the way yeah. that the state uses it is basically what is empowering to women is what is empowering to the state and makes us look
right.
good.
Yeah.
Also
yeah.
corporations. Mm-hmm. It's whatever we think looks pretty on you. It's whatever we think, you know, is yeah. power for right. women, your yeah. proper place. That's what's empowering. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's usually how that conversation ends up going. That's usually what's considered the right answer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's really why this answer, like this question is like so popular in media, because right. it's really what they're trying to debate. So we're having this like return to nationalism where yeah. mm-hmm. the state really needs to control its women again.
Yeah.
And women mm-hmm. are not considered full people. They're not considered full citizens. So anything that they do is a product of debate, and the public has to decide if they think that women should be allowed to do what they right. want, or like
right.
what the proper thing to do.
Right.
Our whole country is represented by women. So we have Colombia. We have the Statue of Liberty. Back in the day, pirates would, even today, like boats are usually named after women. mm-hmm. And women are supposed to represent the nation. They represent yeah. your race, and they prove that you're superior. Mm-hmm. This is why we get into debates of like conservative girls versus leftist girls. Who's hotter?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the hottest girls and the side of the hotter, more moral girls is the correct side. So
yeah,
this is why women like Melania Trump, is she moral? Well, she used to do nudes back in the day, and that means Obama's wife is better, and that means yeah. that Democrats are better because we're more moral. Our women are more moral. They keep their clothes on. I do think yeah. Michelle is better than Melania,
yeah.
obviously.
I like her better too, but not because she was naked, not because she wasn't naked. I could care less about who's been naked. And I say that as somebody who's been naked online a lot. Yeah, I think that I agree with everything that you're saying about that. And I do think that conversation is a smokescreen for for so many things. But yeah.
You can talk about this forever because it's a philosophical question and it has right. no basis in reality. Mm-hmm. So for instance, the word empowerment itself begs the question of who's asking the question. What is right. that person considered to be empowering? Like, for whose empowerment, really?
Right.
So mm-hmm. every time I see people address this question, and especially if it's like white feminists doing it, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see this pattern that they're just like obsessed with migrant maids and sex workers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And from what I have seen from these white women doing these investigations and becoming experts, is that they will cosplay as like maids and then be like, I didn't feel empowered cleaning up toilets. It felt very disempowering for me. Like, if these women had PhDs, they would never choose this. They're migrants. They don't have, no woman can ever choose this. And then they'll, like, you know, go on all the newspapers and all the events, usually among like liberals and leftists, and be like, guys, you have to stop hiring maids. You can't buy a maid. Don't, because they don't choose it. this is a real thing. Like, I like bring this up in debate sometimes and they don't believe me. So I like made a list of the women who have done this and still continue to do that. And that's like that's their whole fucking career is literally maids can't consent. They are oppressed. And I speak for them. The woman who wrote, what was it called? Nickeled and Dimed, I believe. She's like the leftist darling. That's her whole thing.
Ehrenreich, something like that. Barbara something Ehrenreich, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that's her whole thing. She went undercover as a maid. And then God, I read this book in high school and I just like, it felt so gross to me. And I remember not really understanding it. Because it's so clear that the book was not written for me. And I remember just reading it and be like, wow, this is what they think of us.
Yeah.
This is the way they see us. She could have been describing my mother.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Right. It was so condescending though. Like she acted like she was a celebrity because she was of an upper class and she was like upset in the beginning because they're like, they for some reason aren't able to detect that I don't belong here with them. That like I'm very smart. Yeah. I have a PhD. Mm-hmm. Like, how are they not able to see that I'm special? Like, it's just, that was like the book. It was so annoying.
I agree. Obvious
of like she described what it was like to clean a toilet. And she, you know, it was very disempowering for her.
She's never had to do that in her life. So she.
I mean, basically what it is, the Suite Life. With Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, they degrade themselves because they work regular jobs. So they go out to the farm or something and they're like crying, you know, having to clean. They're like, oh, this is so hard. And that's entertainment because it's so awesome to see them debased to our level. But what's great about the show is that the show depicts these people as stupid. Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie are stupid. They're out of touch with reality. Most of the people in the show that they live with give them weird looks. My God, like, what's a Walmart? Like, what do they do there? Do they sell balls? And that's how I view these people, even though they're seen as, oh my God, they're these amazing academics and they speak for the marginalized migrant women. And I want to live in a society where we view these people as like Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie being like, oh my God, guys, I was told what to do. Yeah. And you have to serve people with a smile. You have to wear high heels. I cleaned someone's tooth and it was gross. Yeah. I mean, it was horrible. And good thing you have someone with a PhD coming from their ivory tower to explain this to you. Otherwise, we would never know. I am at the Maya Morena. And on Instagram, I am Real Maya Morena, spelled MAYAMORENA.
And I am Jesse Sage, and I'm on Twitter at Sapiotextual, and you can find my other stuff at jessesage.com, and also you should check out our Peep Show Media at peepshowmedia.com.
And now, here's your next episode of My Labor Radio.
How you doing, everybody? This is Mark, your host, and welcome to this episode of My Labor Radio. Up next is former candidate Tim Barr. Tim ran for State Senate District 16, wanting to run against Justin Bush. Did not get there, but trust me, you'll probably see him around helping politics all over Northeast Indiana. He's here to help. Young guy, full of energy and bringing the right attitude. Best thing, too, is he is a teacher. He's a teacher who understands politics and understands how to communicate with our legislators. Whether they're listening to him or not, Tim's going to give the right perspective when it comes to teachers and their needs in the classroom. Because trust me, most of the people in that supermajority Republican Party are trying to crush public education still. Even if we put 20,000 people outside of that state house in November of 2019, they act like there's nothing wrong. We're doing this to help people have the freedom of choice. You want to kick him in the shin? So do I. This is my interview with Tim Barr. Talk about school last year. I mean, take yourself back to February of 2020. You're hearing it on the news. You're wondering how it's going to impact you. You're going to school, not getting a lot of answers. And then all of a sudden, everything hits the fan and it all changed. How did that last semester really play out for you in school last year?
It's tough looking back at it because there were a lot of students who just kind of, you know, got lost in the gaps. They stopped doing assignment, not attending school online. Maybe it was by choice. They lacked motivation. Maybe they didn't have like a good quality internet connection. My district is the largest geographic district in the state. So we have a lot of rural areas too. So I understand, you know, internet access can be tough, or maybe you're sharing already limited internet access with a mom and a dad who might be working from home. So trying to learn from home at the same time, it's really taxing and tough on them.
Yeah.
For teachers, for me, I wasn't as nervous about it because, well, I'm 28 years old. I've grown up playing PlayStation and Xbox. I'm pretty handy with internet and teaching like that. But there are some teachers who are really good teachers who this is a totally new experience for them, teaching remotely, teaching online. So it's overwhelming for teachers and students and parents and everyone in between.
School nurses, as far as resources in the facility, I mean, obviously you're going to probably have to get your own masks. Is the school system providing masks for students and or staff?
Our district has provided every student and staff member with, I think, at least 2 reusable masks. And then they always have the disposable ones in the office or something like that if there's a kid that shows up and forgets it, which is weird that you can forget that, you know, as long as we've been doing it. But it happens. You'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't, how many masks we find just laying in the hallway.
Sure.
Maybe a kid loses one out of his backpack after practice or something.
Strange situation. I mean, all the things you ever learned or were part of or student taught, and you work with somebody who's taught for 35 years, and they're giving you all these scenarios of things. Never was a pandemic part of that discussion, I'm sure.
And yeah, it's funny that you bring that up because, you know, I was looking through the list of hundreds of bills that impact education earlier, and you know, some of them are about what teachers need to learn at teacher college. And we're going through a pandemic and they can't train you for necessarily every single thing. So it's always interesting what they decide that we do need to be prepared for.
Well, let's talk about that. So the legislature is supermajority, and all the Democrats as a minority can do is go, hey, you know, we don't agree with that. And meanwhile, they just steamroll right over us. So really, it's the power and the money. So if it's educational freedoms or the liberty of education, or we want a big choice, and then the vouchers, they're really just taking away more collective bargaining rights and, of course, taking away more opportunity for public education to raise any wages in any way for teachers. Thoughts about a couple bills, or is something you want to talk about that's legislatively happening right now here in the spring in the State House?
Yeah, definitely. I'm upset with, well, a lot of people, obviously. I'm upset with your representative in the State House. I was able to meet with him last session just before schools got kicked out and everyone was quarantining.
Tim is referring to Matt Lehman, who is House District 79, and he's my representative. That's who he's speaking about here.
Representative Lehman said, you know, why are you guys so focused on this 1%, this little bit that is school choice, when you guys have most of it? And I told him, because we're already underfunded, or understaffed, overworked. We need more money. And I'm trying to tell you where we can go and find more. that doesn't impact the budget at all. It's already allocated for. And then last night, Representative Heine and Senator Cruz were on PBS 39 for their thing. I called in because I was pretty upset with what Representative Heine said. And it's a constant talking point that they make up that we don't set your salaries. That's a local decision. Well, you do control funding. You hamstring what we can collectively bargain by putting severe restrictions on it. And then we have the continued privatization of public education. When you take money out of public ed and you give it to all these corporations, private schools, things like that, you're essentially defunding schools.
Which was their ultimate goal.
Right.
Thank you very much for your time, Tim. I do appreciate it.
No, hey, thanks for your time. Thanks for having me. It was
checking in with you again too, real soon. Thank you very much, Tim.
Good. Thank you. Bye.
The New York State AFL-CIO. I'm Darcy Wells, and this is Union Strong. Joining me to talk about the adult use cannabis industry is Nikki Kateman, the political and communications director at Local 338 of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union and United Food and Commercial Workers, an affiliate of the New York State AFL-CIO, and Tim McNutt, a former prosecutor who's now the director of Criminal Justice and Employment Initiative at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. So thank you both for joining me for this discussion.
Great to be with you, Darcy. Thank you for having us.
In the new industry, what does it mean in terms of revenue and job creation?
So I'll start with job creation. Okay. There was a proposal, a study done by the Rockefeller Institute 2 years ago now that estimated that if about 30,000 jobs could be created directly within the adult use cannabis industry. In the governor's budget proposal presentation, that figure was about 60,000 jobs. And why this is really particularly exciting is, you know, there's a space to make pretty good quality jobs, union jobs directly within the cannabis industry. So that's, you know, workers who will be in cultivation centers, processing, distribution within the retail dispensaries. But what doesn't necessarily get a lot of attention also is all the different ancillary businesses that are going to be opened and that support the adult use industry directly. And I think that often gets overlooked because there is going to be need for advertising and legal and accounting and HVAC and construction jobs that really are going to be facilitating a market opening in New York that, you know, we can't do have a good system without those businesses. In terms of revenue, there's, you know, been, you know, I think the state has it listed at about $300 million in new tax revenue. But then again, that's even conservative because it doesn't necessarily take into account the larger economic impact that this is going to have around, you know, the jobs that are being created, the community reinvestment that's going to happen. But in relation to that as well is, obviously, the social equity program is a critical component of cannabis legalization and what the program is going to look like. And the investment that's going to be made in communities that have been disproportionately impacted by prohibition and criminalization and the economic impact that's going to have on communities. Mm-hmm. It's hard to put a dollar amount on that.
Are there things that we learned from the medical cannabis program that can be carried over to adult use?
I think one of the critical lessons we've learned from the medical cannabis program is really around jobs, right? Because part of the program, besides, you know, the obvious of access for patients, you know, as an alternative treatment for their chronic conditions and illnesses, I think one of the things that was interesting about the program was it was, you know, pitched kind of as a opportunity for new jobs, particularly in upstate New York. And we've seen the state and through the medical program create, you know, hundreds of really good quality jobs. And I think that's one of the lessons that we can take into the adult use program is we've negotiated really strong union contracts and set a standard for what careers can and should look like in the cannabis industry in New York. And I think that's a real opportunity for a lesson learned is, you know, we've really, these have been, you know, job centers in some of the communities upstate where the cultivation facilities are. And there's a real opportunity to grow on that, no pun intended, in the adult use program. And, you know, for all the different cultivation facilities that are going to be opening and manufacturing processing, it really creates an opportunity for what we can see as long-term careers where people, you know, stay in their jobs, enjoy their jobs, and really get to have family-sustaining wages and benefits.
So as a prosecutor, former prosecutor, Tim, you know, what have you seen or what do you draw from as far as lives impacted by the war on drugs and what's needed to help these people to start over? Because some of that might just be the fact that they have this criminal record and employers might be hesitant to want to bring them in, I would imagine.
People of color have been disproportionately affected by mass incarceration. And though Blacks and Latinos represent only 30% of the population, they comprise over half of those incarcerated. The war on drugs was really a significant driver to this. Rockefeller drug laws in New York State, federally, the Sentencing Reform Act, disparity in sentences for the distribution of cocaine and crack that's been widely covered, three strikes laws. And we're at a point where almost 70 million Americans have some form of a criminal record. And part of that system is criminal records, the way that we document criminal convictions that sort of stays with an individual for their lifetime. We also know that these records have errors. And then the professional background screening companies that often employers rely on to do background checks often contain errors as well. And these errors can cause really negative impacts to someone trying to get a job. And we formed this initiative to really help address those issues that I just described and reduce barriers to employment for people with criminal records.
I thank both of you for joining me on the podcast. Thanks for listening to the Union Strong podcast. If you like what you're hearing, you can subscribe and give us a rating. This has been a production of the New York State AFL-CIO. Our president is Mario Salento. Our secretary treasurer is Terry Melvin. We're a federation of 3,000 unions representing 2.5 million union members, retirees, and their families with one goal: to raise the standard of living and quality of life of all working people. We keep New York State Union strong by fighting for better wages, better benefits, and better working conditions. For more information on the labor movement in New York, visit nysaflcio.org. Until next time, stay union and stay strong.
Hey, folks. This is Stephen Pitts, host of Black Work Talk, an Organizing Upgrade podcast. It is good to remember Frederick Douglass's insistence that power concedes nothing without a demand. Our guest this week on Black Work Talk fully understands what Douglass meant. William A. Lucy retired in 2010 after over 50 years as a leader of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, at this local and national level. Since 1972, Bill had been the Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME, the number two officer in the union. I've known Bill for over 10 years, but I've known of Bill for decades because of his role in supporting the sanitation workers in Memphis during their 1968 strike and his role in co-founding the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists in 1972. He has been a consistent advocate for Black workers within the labor movement, while simultaneously insisting on the importance of union and union jobs in raising the quality of life in the Black community. If we could get a group of young Black unionists, what would you talk to them about your assessment of the current day, recommendation? What would you say?
I would say what Dr. King said, that the power to bring about social change is caught by and large between two movements, the workers' movement and the social and religious movement. So if we want to improve the quality of life for workers and improve the quality of life for our communities, we got to figure out how to get these two groups together. And I'm certainly not one who has thought through it enough to know what the absolute answer is. But young Black workers got to understand that now is the perfect time for them to take over a leadership role in organized labor, to really get in and become a part of building a stronger movement for the purpose of better wages, better working conditions, better social policies, better policies that affect our day-to-day lives. If your mission is to organize a union that its mission is a nickel more an hour, that's not what's going to deal with the broad array of issues that we've got. We've got to build a social movement, one that is committed to improving the quality of life for everybody. And if we are effective in doing it, it'll be able to stand up against the money crowd. It'll see the basic issues as issues that are improvement in the quality of life. There's a lot of work to be done. And as you well know, there are parts of this movement whose only commitment is to a nickel more an hour. But they could pay you $1,000 an hour and you have no dignity and no respect. That's not an environment that's going to contribute to a healthy community that we want to live in.
How would you define Black freedom?
That's
the wind down question, okay?
I think we want to live in a society that starts us off with a level playing field so that our accomplishments and achievements based on our ability to compete in a society that's not going to judge us, as Dr. King says, just by the color of our skin. And I think that our movement has to be focused on achieving those goals. And when you raise the question, I thought about South Africa. When we joined the anti-apartheid movement, you know, and we would meet with some of the young trade unionists from there and talk about how they started. And they simply said they wanted to live like any other free person in the land of their birth. They didn't have a specific definition of it, but they knew it wasn't what they were living with then. And I'm sure now that we have such a complicated economic system. We have such complicated economic policies that there's always going to be differences between various groups in our system. And I think a free and democratic trade union environment is one that sees the differences and fights to make them less impactful on those who are least able to deal with it. You know, our current labor law really almost designed to help those who are doing very well do better. Those who are not doing well, the law does nothing to help them do better. That may not have come out of it. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. If you are organized today, the law gives you a tool to get stronger organized. But if you aren't organized at all, you out of luck, basically. That's what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes, I will. If you're a skills tradesman, if you learn the unique skill that gives you a leg up, you've got the right to organize. You've got the right to bargain collectively. You've got the right to fight for all of the benefits of organization. But if you're a retail worker, if you're a healthcare worker, a daycare worker, a day laborer, all the other so-called jobs now that they made it essential in the last 6 or 7 months, if you're those kinds of workers, the law is not designed to help you. You can win an election and maybe in 2 years get to sit down at a bargain table with a new boss and a whole new workforce. We've got to figure out a way where the law is available to the lowest class worker. And it gets back to the sanitation situation. How can you have, as Dr. King says, people who work every single day yet can't raise themselves out of poverty? I mean, there's just something contradictory.
In
our system.
Thanks for joining me here this week on Black Work Talk. I hope this podcast can grow to be part of a network of our movement for change. We need your help as we build the Black Work Talk community. Please subscribe to the podcast wherever you find your podcasts and go to Patreon to become a sustainer. Until the next episode, stay safe and be well.
That's it for this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 80 labor radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net and find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. Also, check out our weekly live stream show available at Labor Radio Net on Facebook and Labor Radio Podcast Network's YouTube, where you'll also find profiles of members of the network. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. See you next time.